It was a mistake any wizard could make, who was tired and caught on the hop. One piffling error, and then, to my terror, I found myself facing the chop. Alas, for the eve when I met Lady Grieve, a-strolling the park in the dusk. She was of the belief I could straighten her teeth. Next moment, she'd sprouted a tusk. I cried through the night that I'd soon put her right, but the process of justice was lax. They'd brought out the block, though they'd mislaid the rock where they usually sharpened the axe. Next morning at dawn, with a face most forlorn, the priest said to try not to cry. You can come just like that. No, you won't need a hat. And I knew that my end must be nigh. The man in the mask who would have the sad task of cleaving my head from my neck said, Nick, if you please, will you get to your knees? And I turned to a gibbering wreck. This may sting a bit, said the cack-handed twit, as he swung the axe up in the air. But oh, the blunt blade, no difference it made. My head was still definitely there. The axeman, he hacked and he whacked and he thwacked. Won't be too long, he assured me. But quick it was not, and the bone-headed clot took 45 goes till he floored me. And so I was dead. But my faithful old head, it never saw fit to desert me. It still lingers on. That's the end of my song. And now, please applaud, or you'll hurt me.
Peeves. Are you ghouly or ghosty or wee student beastie? Says Peeves, one night when Harry, Ron, and Hermione alert him to their nighttime wanderings beneath Harry's invisibility cloak. Funnily enough, Peeves himself is not really any of those things. So what is he?
The name Poltergeist is German in origin, and roughly translates as noisy ghost, although it is not, strictly speaking, a ghost at all. The poltergeist is an invisible entity that moves objects, slams doors, and creates other audible kinetic disturbances. It has been reported in many cultures that there is a strong association with the places where young people, especially adolescents, are living. Explanations for the phenomenon vary all the way from supernatural to scientific. It was inevitable that, in a building bursting with teenage witches and wizards, a poltergeist would be generated. It was likewise to be expected that such a poltergeist would be noisier, more destructive, and harder to expel than those that occasionally frequent Muggle houses. Sure enough, Peeves is the most notorious and troublesome poltergeist in British history. Unlike the overwhelming majority of his colleagues, Peeves has a physical form, though he is able to become invisible at will. His looks reflect his nature, which those who know him would agree is a seamless blend of humour and malice. Peeves is well named, for he has been a pet peeve of every Hogwarts caretaker from Hankerton Humble, appointed by the four founders, onwards. Though many students and even teachers have a somewhat perverse fondness for Peeves, he undoubtedly adds a certain zest to school life. He is incurably disruptive, and it generally falls to the caretaker of the day to clean up his many deliberate messes. Vases smashed, potions upended, bookcases toppled, and so on. Those with weak nerves deplore Peeves's fondness for suddenly materializing an inch from the end of their noses, hiding in suits of armor, or dropping solid objects on their heads as they move between classes. Several concerted efforts to remove Peeves from the castle have resulted in failure. The last and most disastrous was made in 1876 by caretaker Rancorous Carp, who devised an elaborate trap, baited with an assortment of weapons he believed would be irresistible to Peeves, and a vast enchanted bell jar, reinforced by various containment charms, which he intended to drop over the poltergeist once he was in place. Not only did Peeves break easily through the giant bell jar, showering an entire corridor with broken glass, he also escaped the trap armed with several cutlasses, crossbows, a blunderbuss, and a miniature cannon. The castle was evacuated, while Peeves amused himself by firing randomly out of the windows and threatening all and sundry with death. A 3-day standoff was ended when the headmistress of the day, Eupraxia Mole, agreed to sign a contract allowing Peeves additional privileges, such as a once-weekly swim in the boys' toilets on the ground floor, first refusal on stale bread from the kitchen for throwing purposes, and a new hat, to be custom-made by Madame Bonhabille of Paris. Rancorous Carp took early retirement for health reasons, and no subsequent attempt has ever been made to rid the castle of its most ill-disciplined inhabitant. Peeves does recognize authority of a sort. Though generally unimpressed by titles and badges, he is generally amenable to the strictures of the teachers, agreeing to stay out of their classrooms while they teach. He has also been known to show an affinity for rare students, notably Fred and George Weasley, and is certainly afraid of the ghost of Slytherin, the Bloody Baron.
Ministers for Magic. Peeves and the Hogwarts ghosts might stay firmly put within the castle walls, but the school's student residents soon grow up, graduate, and move on, after which an impressive number seem to secure themselves jobs at the Ministry of Magic. As we discover in Cursed Child, Harry becomes the Ministry's head of magical law enforcement, which is the very department that once tried him for performing the Patronus charm in front of his cousin Dudley. And Hermione becomes the Minister for Magic, succeeding the great Kingsley Shacklebolt. Really, where else would she end up?
The Ministry of Magic was formally established in 1707 with the appointment of the very first man to hold the title, Minister for Magic, Ulic Gamp.
Footnote. Prior to 1707, the Wizards' Council was the longest-serving, though not the only, body to govern the magical community in Britain. After the imposition of the International Statute of Secrecy in 1692, however, the wizarding community needed a more highly structured, organized, a more complex governing structure than they had hitherto used to support, regulate, and communicate with the community in hiding. Only witches and wizards who enjoy the title of Minister for Magic are included in this entry.
The Minister for Magic is democratically elected, although there have been times of crisis in which the post has simply been offered to an individual without a public vote. Albus Dumbledore was made such an offer and turned it down repeatedly. There is no fixed limit to a minister's term of office, but he or she is obliged to hold regular elections at a maximum interval of 7 years. Ministers for magic tend to last much longer than Muggle ministers. Generally speaking, and despite many a moan and grumble, their community is behind them in a way that is rarely seen in the Muggle world. This is perhaps due to a feeling, on the part of wizards, that unless they are seen to manage themselves competently, the Muggles might try to interfere. The Muggle Prime Minister has no part in appointing the Minister for Magic, whose election is a matter only for the magical community themselves. All matters relating to the magical community in Britain are managed solely by the Minister for Magic, and they have sole jurisdiction over their ministry. Emergency visits to the Muggle Prime Minister by the Minister for Magic are announced by a portrait of Ulic Gamp, First Minister for Magic, that hangs in the Muggle Prime Minister's study in No. 10 Downing Street. No Muggle Prime Minister has ever set foot in the Ministry of Magic, for reasons most succinctly summed up by ex-minister Dugald MacPhail, term of office, 1858 to 1865.
Their poor wee brains couldn't cope it.
Minister Ulic Gamp, term of office, 1707 to 1718. Previously head of the Wizengamot, Gamp had the onerous job of policing a fractious and frightened community, adjusting to the imposition of the International Statute of Secrecy. His greatest legacy was to found the Department of Magical Law Enforcement. Damocles' Raoul, 1718 to 1726. Raoul was elected on a platform of being tough on muggles. Censured by the International Confederation of Wizards, he was eventually forced to step down. Perseus Parkinson, 1726 to 1733. Attempted to pass a bill making it illegal to marry a muggle, misread the public mood. The wizarding community, tired of anti-muggle sentiment and wanting peace, voted him out at the first opportunity. Eldritch Diggory, 1733 to 1747. Popular minister who first established an aura recruitment program, died in office, dragonpox. Albert Boot, 1747 to 1752. Likeable but inept. Resigned after a mismanaged goblin rebellion. Basil Flack, 1752 to 1752. Shortest serving minister, lasted 2 months. Resigned after the goblins joined forces with werewolves. Hephaestus Gore, 1752 to 1770. Gore was one of the earliest aurors. Successfully put down a number of revolts by magical beings, although historians feel his refusal to contemplate rehabilitation programs for werewolves ultimately led to more attacks, renovated and reinforced the prison of Azkaban. Maximilian Crowdy, 1770 to 1781. Father of nine, Crowdy was a charismatic leader who rooted out several extremist pureblood groups planning muggle attacks. His mysterious death in office has been the subject of numerous books and conspiracy theories. Porteous Knatchbull, 1781 to 1789, was called in confidentially in 1782 by the Muggle Prime Minister of the day, Lord North, to see whether he could help with King George III's emerging mental instability. Word leaked out that Lord North believed in wizards, and he was forced to resign after a motion of no confidence. Unctuous Osbert, 1789 to 1798. Widely seen as too much influenced by purebloods of wealth and status. Artemisia Lufkin, 1798 to 1811. First female minister for magic. Established Department of International Magical Cooperation and lobbied hard and successfully to have a Quidditch World Cup tournament held in Britain during her term. Grogan Stump, 1811 to 1819. Very popular minister for magic. A passionate Quidditch fan. Tuthill Tornadoes. Established Department of Magical Games and Sports. And managed to steer through legislation on magical beasts and beings that had long been a source of contention. Josephina Flint, 1819 to 1827. Revealed an unhealthy anti-muggle bias in office, disliked new muggle technology such as the telegraph, which she claimed interfered with proper wand function. Ottoline Gamble, 1827 to 1835. A much more forward-looking minister, Gamble established committees to investigate muggle brain power, which seemed, during this period of the British Empire, to be greater than some wizards had credited. Rodolphus Lestrange, 1835 to 1841. Reactionary, who attempted to close down the Department of Mysteries, which ignored him. Eventually resigned due to ill health, which was widely rumoured to be inability to cope with the strains of office. Hortensia Millefoot, 1841 to 1849. Introduced more legislation than any other sitting minister. Much of it useful, but some wearisome. Hat pointiness and so on, which ultimately resulted in her political downfall. Evangeline Orpington, 1849 to 1855. A good friend of Queen Victoria's, who never realized she was a witch, let alone minister for magic. Orpington is believed to have intervened magically and illegally in the Crimean War. Priscilla Dupont, 1855 to 1858. Conceived an irrational loathing of the Muggle Prime Minister Lord Palmerston, to an extent that caused such trouble, coins turning to frog spawn in his coat pockets, etc., that she was forced to step down. Ironically, Palmerston was forced to resign by the Muggles 2 days later. Dugald MacPhail, 1858 to 1865. A safe pair of hands. While the Muggle Parliament underwent a period of marked upheaval, the Ministry of Magic knew a period of welcome calm. Faris Spouthole Spavin, 1865 to 1903. Longest ever serving Minister for Magic, and also the most long-winded. He survived an assassination attempt, kicking from a centaur, who resented the punchline of Spavin's infamous "A centaur, a ghost, and a dwarf walked into a bar" joke. Attended Queen Victoria's funeral in an admiral's hat and spats, at which point the wizengamot suggested gently that it was time he moved aside. Spavin was 147 when he left office. Venusia Crickerly, 1903 to 1912, second ex-aura to take office, and considered both competent and likable. Crickerly died in a freak gardening accident, mandrake-related. Archer Evermond, 1912 to 1923. In post during the Muggle First World War, Evermond passed emergency legislation forbidding witches and wizards to get involved, lest they risk mass infractions of the International Statute of Secrecy. Thousands defied him, aiding Muggles where they could. Lorcan MacLeod, 1923 to 1925. A gifted wizard, but an unlikely politician. MacLeod was an exceptionally taciturn man who preferred to communicate in monosyllables and expressive puffs of smoke that he produced through the end of his wand, forced from office out of sheer irritation at his eccentricities. Hector Fawley, 1925 to 1939. Undoubtedly, voted in because of his marked difference to MacLeod. The ebullient and flamboyant Fawley did not take sufficiently seriously the threat presented to the world wizarding community by Gellert Grindelwald. He paid with his job. Leonard Spencer Moon, 1939 to 1948. A sound minister who rose through the ranks from being tea boy in the Department of Magical Accidents and Catastrophes, oversaw a great period of international wizarding and Muggle conflict, enjoyed a good working relationship with Winston Churchill. Wilhelmina Tuft, 1948 to 1959. Cheery witch who presided over a period of welcome peace and prosperity, died in office after discovering too late her allergy to Alahotsi-flavoured fudge. Ignatius Tuft, 1959 to 1962. Son of the above, a hardliner who capitalized on his mother's popularity to gain election, promised to institute a controversial and dangerous dementor breeding program and was forced from office. Nobby Leach, 1962 to 1968. First Muggle-born minister for magic, his appointment caused consternation among the old pure-blood guard, many of whom resigned government posts in protest. Has always denied having anything to do with England's 1966 World Cup win. Left office after contracting mysterious illness. Conspiracy theories abound. Eugenia Jenkins, 1968 to 1975. Jenkins dealt competently with pureblood riots during squib rights marches in the late 60s. But was soon confronted with the first rise of Lord Voldemort. Jenkins was soon ousted from office as inadequate to the challenge. Harold Mincham, 1975 to 1980. Seen as a hardliner, he placed even more dementors around Azkaban, but was unable to contain what looked like Voldemort's unstoppable rise to power. Millicent Bagnold, 1980 to 1990. A highly able minister had to answer to the International Confederation of Wizards for the number of breaches of the International Statute of Secrecy on the day and night following Harry Potter's survival of Lord Voldemort's attack. Acquitted herself magnificently with the now infamous words, "I assert our inalienable right to party," which drew cheers from all present. Cornelius Fudge, 1990 to 1996. A career politician overly fond of the old guard. Persistent denial of the continuing threat of Lord Voldemort ultimately cost him his job. Rufus Scrimgeour, 1996 to 1997. The third ex-Auror to gain office, Scrimgeour died in office at the hands of Lord Voldemort. Pius Thicknesse, 1997 to 1998. Omitted from most official records, as he was under the imperious curse for his entire term of office and unconscious of anything that he was doing. Kingsley Shacklebolt, 1998 to present. Oversaw the capture of Death Eaters and Voldemort supporters following the death of Lord Voldemort. Initially named as caretaker minister, Shacklebolt was subsequently elected to the office.
Hogwarts portraits. Important or self-important they may be, you won't find any ministers for magic displayed on the walls of Hogwarts. Instead, the portraits that adorn the castle's corridors and common rooms show historical Wizarding World figures of varying significance, while the pictures in the head study depict previous headmasters and headmistresses of varying helpfulness. And while a portrait can never be an adequate substitute for its subject, as Professor McGonagall tells Harry in Cursed Child, I was advised as I took this job to not mistake the painting for the person. Portraits of previous Hogwarts heads do have many uses.
Hogwarts portraits are able to talk and move around from picture to picture. They behave like their subjects. However, the degree to which they can interact with the people looking at them depends not on the skill of the painter, but on the power of the witch or wizard painted. When a magical portrait is taken, the witch or wizard artist will naturally use enchantments to ensure that the painting will be able to move in the usual way. The portrait will be able to use some of the subject's favorite phrases and imitate their general demeanor. Thus, Sir Cadogan's portrait is forever challenging people to a fight, falling off its horse and behaving in a fairly unbalanced way, which is how the subject appeared to the poor wizard who had to paint him. While the portrait of the fat lady continues to indulge her love of good food, drink, and tip-top security long after her living model passed away. However, neither of these portraits would be capable of having a particularly in-depth discussion about more complex aspects of their lives. They are literally and metaphorically two-dimensional. They are only representations of the living subjects as seen by the artist. Some magical portraits are capable of considerably more interaction with the living world. Traditionally, a headmaster or headmistress is painted before their death. Once the portrait is completed, the headmaster or headmistress in question keeps it under lock and key, regularly visiting it in its cupboard, if so desired, to teach it to act and behave exactly like themselves, and imparting all kinds of useful memories and pieces of knowledge that may then be shared through the centuries with their successors in office. The depth of knowledge and insight contained in some of the headmasters and headmistresses' portraits is unknown to any but the incumbents of the office and the few students who have realized over the centuries that the portrait's apparent sleepiness when visitors arrive in the office is not necessarily genuine.
Sir Cadogan. Sir Cadogan may be slightly unbalanced, but he is certainly no scurvy braggart. Indeed, according to Percy Weasley, he is the only portrait subject brave enough to become Gryffindor's password keeper after the fat lady's picture is attacked by Sirius Black. As such, Sir Cadogan's portrait surely merits a little closer inspection. Stand and fight, scoundrels!
Before the wizarding community was forced into hiding, it was not unusual for a wizard to live in the Muggle community and hold down what we would now think of as a Muggle job. It is widely believed in wizarding circles that Sir Cadogan was one of the famous knights of the Round Table, albeit a little known one, and that he achieved this position through his friendship with Merlin. He has certainly been excised from all Muggle volumes of King Arthur's story, but wizarding versions of the tales include Sir Cadogan alongside Sir Lancelot, Sir Bedivere, and Sir Percival. These tales reveal him to be hot-headed and peppery, and brave to the point of foolhardiness, but a good man in a corner. Sir Cadogan's most famous encounter was with the Wyvern of Wye, a dragonish creature that was terrorizing the West Country. At their first encounter, the beast ate Sir Cadogan's handsome steed, bit his wand in half, and melted his sword and visor. Unable to see through the steam rising from his melting helmet, Sir Cadogan barely escaped with his life. However, rather than running away, he staggered into a nearby meadow, grabbed a small, fat pony grazing there, leapt upon it, and galloped back towards the wyvern with nothing but his broken wand in his hand, prepared to meet a valiant death. The creature lowered its fearsome head to swallow Sir Cadogan and the pony whole, but the splintered and misfiring wand pierced its tongue, igniting the gassy fumes rising from its stomach and causing the wyvern to explode. Elderly witches and wizards still use the saying, "I'll take Cadogan's pony," to mean, "I'll salvage the best I can from a tricky situation." Sir Cadogan's portrait, which hangs on the 7th floor of Hogwarts Castle, shows him with the pony he rode forevermore, which, understandably perhaps, never much liked him, and accurately depicts his hot temper, his love of a foolhardy challenge, and his determination to beat the enemy, come what may.
Azkaban. When Sirius attacks the fat lady's portrait, he is acting out of desperation, his reputation already in tatters. He's recently escaped Azkaban, a feat that makes him seem particularly dangerous when taken on top of the crime for which he'd been unjustly imprisoned, the alleged murder of his old friend and fellow marauder, Peter Pettigrew. Although he should never have been there, there's no doubt 12 years in Azkaban changed Sirius. I think the only reason I never lost my mind is that I knew I was innocent, he tells Harry, Ron and Hermione. But I was weak, very weak. It's obvious that Azkaban and its Dementor guards are not part of a prison system that believes in reform. But how does it manage to so completely wreck the sanity and sap the will of most of its inhabitants?
Azkaban has existed since the 15th century and was not originally a prison at all. The island in the North Sea upon which the first fortress was built never appeared on any map, Muggle or wizarding, and is believed to have been created or enlarged by magical means. The fortress upon it was originally home to a little-known sorcerer who called himself Ecristus. Evidently extremely powerful but of unknown nationality, Ecristus, who is believed to have been insane, was a practitioner of the worst kinds of dark arts. Alone in the middle of the ocean, he lured, tortured, and killed Muggle sailors, apparently for pleasure, and only when he died and the concealment charms he had cast faded away did the Ministry of Magic realize that either island or building existed. Those who entered to investigate refused afterwards to talk of what they had found inside, but the least frightening part of it was that the place was infested with Dementors. Many in authority thought Azkaban an evil place that was best destroyed. Others were afraid of what might happen to the Dementors infesting the building if they deprived them of their home. The creatures were already strong and impossible to kill. Many feared a horrible revenge if they took away a habitat where they appeared to thrive. The very walls of the building seemed steeped in misery and pain, and the Dementors were determined to cling to it. Experts who had studied buildings built with and around dark magic contended that Azkaban might wreak its own revenge upon anybody attempting to destroy it. The fortress was therefore left, abandoned for many years, a home to continually breeding Dementors. Once the International Statute of Secrecy had been imposed, the Ministry of Magic felt that the small wizarding prisons that existed up and down the country in various towns and villages posed a security risk, because attempts by incarcerated witches and wizards to break out often led to undesirable bangs, smells, and light shows. A purpose-built prison, located on some remote Hebridean island, was preferred, and plans had been drawn up when Damocles Raoul became Minister for Magic. Raoul was an authoritarian who had risen to power on an anti-Muggle agenda, capitalizing on the anger felt by much of the wizarding community at being forced to go underground. Sadistic by nature, Raoul scrapped the plans for the new prison at once and insisted on using Azkaban. He claimed that the Dementors living there were an advantage. They could be harnessed as guards, saving the ministry time, trouble, and expense. In spite of opposition from many wizards, among them experts on both Dementors and buildings with Azkaban's kind of dark history, Raoul carried out his plan, and soon a steady trickle of prisoners had been placed there. None ever emerged. If they were not mad and dangerous before being placed in Azkaban, they swiftly became so. Raoul was succeeded by Perseus Parkinson, who was likewise pro-Azkaban. By the time that Eldritch Diggory took over as Minister for Magic, the prison had been operating for 15 years. There had been no breakouts and no breaches of security. The new prison seemed to be working well. It was only when Diggory went to visit that he realized exactly what the conditions inside were like. Prisoners were mostly insane, and a graveyard had been established to accommodate those that died of despair. Back in London, Diggory established a committee to explore alternatives to Azkaban, or at least to remove the Dementors as guards. Experts explained to him that the only reason the Dementors were, mostly, confined to the island was that they were being provided with a constant supply of souls on which to feed. If deprived of prisoners, they were likely to abandon the prison and head for the mainland. This advice, notwithstanding, Diggory had been so horrified by what he had seen inside Azkaban that he pressed the committee to find alternatives. Before they could reach any decision, however, Diggory caught dragonpox and died. From that time until the advent of Kingsley Shacklebolt, no minister ever seriously considered closing Azkaban. They turned a blind eye to the inhumane conditions inside the fortress, permitted it to be magically enlarged and expanded and rarely visited due to the awful effects of entering a building populated by thousands of Dementors. Most justified their attitude by pointing to the prison's perfect record at keeping prisoners locked up. Nearly three centuries passed before that record was broken. A young man was successfully smuggled out of the prison when his visiting mother exchanged places with him, something that the blind and loveless Dementors could not detect and would never have expected. This escape was followed by another, still more ingenious and impressive, when Sirius Black managed to evade the Dementors single-handedly. The weakness of the prison was demonstrated amply over the next few years when two mass breakouts occurred, both involving Death Eaters. By this time, the Dementors had given their allegiance to Lord Voldemort, who could guarantee them scope and freedom hitherto untasted. Albus Dumbledore was one who had long disapproved of the use of Dementors as guards, not only because of the inhumane treatment of the prisoners in their power, but because he foresaw the possible shift in loyalties of such dark creatures. Under Kingsley Shacklebolt, Azkaban was purged of Dementors. While it remains in use as a prison, the guards are now Aurors, who are regularly rotated from the mainland. There has been no breakout since this new system was introduced.
Author's note. The name Azkaban derives from a mixture of the prison Alcatraz, which is its closest Muggle equivalent, being set on an island, and Abaddon, which is a Hebrew word meaning place of destruction or depths of hell.
Chapter 17, Exploring Hogwarts. Sirius Black's escape from Azkaban is arguably his most impressive and certainly his most serious feat, but it is not the first time he successfully evades enemy capture. In his Hogwarts days, Sirius and his fellow marauders, James Potter, Remus Lupin and Peter Pettigrew, made steady progress around the castle and its grounds, mostly by night and often in the form of animals. Sure, they weren't being pursued by Dementors, but their ability to avoid being caught by either professor or student was a solid testament to their exploration and evasion skills, and possibly also to the quality of James Potter's invisibility cloak. We'll get to the Marauders and their magnificent map soon enough, because of course, they weren't the only ones keen to learn as much about Hogwarts as is possible outside a classroom. Generations of students attempted similar illicit reconnaissance missions and nighttime wanderings, from Tom Riddle, to Arthur and Molly Weasley, to cursed child Albus Potter and Scorpius Malfoy. Even Dumbledore is not immune to the odd middle-of-the-night walk, especially when in pursuit of a chamber pot. But with its vast grounds full of magical creatures and its hidden rooms full of whatever the searcher required, no nighttime wanderer could ever hope to uncover all of Hogwarts' secrets. There is, however, someone who can open up a few more doors. In this, the final stop on our Hogwarts tour, J.K. Rowling walks us through some finer details of hidden Hogwarts and sheds a little light on an outstanding mystery or two. The Chamber of Secrets. The opening of the Chamber of Secrets causes major disruption during Harry's second year at Hogwarts. It also caused major disruption for Hagrid years before. In fact, it got him expelled after he was wrongly accused, by Tom Riddle naturally, of being the one who'd opened it, and unleashed the beast that killed Moaning Myrtle, then just plain Myrtle Warren. And yet, for all the trouble it generated, the Chamber of Secrets remained so well hidden for so long, pretty much everyone dismissed it as a legend. Although, as Hermione points out to History of Magic teacher Professor Binns, many legends do have a basis in fact.
The subterranean Chamber of Secrets was created by Salazar Slytherin without the knowledge of his three fellow founders of Hogwarts. The chamber was, for many centuries, believed to be a myth. However, the fact that rumors of its existence persisted for so long reveals that Slytherin spoke of its creation and that others believed him, or else had been permitted by him to enter. There is no doubt that each of the four founders sought to stamp their own mark upon the school of witchcraft and wizardry that they intended would be the finest in the world. It was agreed that each would construct their own houses, for example, choosing the location of common rooms and dormitories. However, only Slytherin went further and built what was in effect a personal, secret headquarters within the school, accessible only by himself or by those he allowed to enter. Perhaps when he first constructed the chamber, Slytherin wanted no more than a place in which to instruct his students in spells of which the other three founders may have disapproved. Disagreements sprung up early around the teaching of the dark arts. However, it is clear by the very decoration of the chamber that by the time Slytherin finished it, he had developed grandiose ideas of his own importance to the school. No other founder left behind them a gigantic statue of themselves or draped the school in emblems of their own personal powers, the snakes carved around the Chamber of Secrets being a reference to Slytherin's powers as a parcel mouth. What is certain is that by the time Slytherin was forced out of the school by the other three founders, he had decided that henceforth, the chamber he had built would be the lair of a monster that he alone, or his descendants, would be able to control, a basilisk. Moreover, only a parcel mouth would be able to enter the chamber. This, he knew, would keep out all three founders and every other member of staff. The existence of the chamber was known to Slytherin's descendants and those with whom they chose to share the information. Thus, the rumor stayed alive through the centuries. There is clear evidence that the chamber was opened more than once between the death of Slytherin and the entrance of Tom Riddle in the 20th century. When first created, the chamber was accessed through a concealed trapdoor and a series of magical tunnels. However, when Hogwarts plumbing became more elaborate in the 18th century, this was a rare instance of wizards copying muggles because hitherto they simply relieved themselves wherever they stood and vanished the evidence, the entrance to the chamber was threatened, being located on the site of a proposed bathroom. The presence in school at the time of a student called Corvinus Gaunt, direct descendant of Slytherin and antecedent of Tom Riddle, explains how the simple trapdoor was secretly protected, so that those who knew how could still access the entrance to the chamber even after new fangled plumbing had been placed on top of it. Whispers that a monster lived in the depths of the castle were also prevalent for centuries. Again, this is because those who could hear and speak to it were not always as discreet as they might have been. The Gaunt family could not resist boasting of their knowledge. As nobody else could hear the creature sliding beneath floorboards or latterly through the plumbing, they did not have many believers, and none, until Riddle, dared unleash the monster on the castle. Successive headmasters and mistresses, not to mention a number of historians, searched the castle thoroughly many times over the centuries, each time concluding that the chamber was a myth. The reason for their failure was simple. None of them was a parcel mouth.
The Great Lake. Located somewhere above the Chamber of Secrets, Hogwarts' Great Lake is home to many fantastical watery beasts and sunken secrets. Even the Marauders couldn't hope to map these vast depths.
The grounds of Hogwarts function partly as a nature reserve for magical creatures which have difficulty existing in muggle-inhabited areas. The lake is full of creatures that would make a muggle naturalist swoon with delight if terror did not seize them first. There are Grindylows, vicious little water demons, merpeople of a hardy Scottish strain, and a giant squid, which is semi-domesticated and permits students to tickle its tentacles on sunny days when it basks in the shallows.
Author's note. The lake is the setting for the second task that the Triwizard competitors must face in Goblet of Fire, which is also my favourite task. I find it satisfyingly creepy. I like the diversity of the methods employed by the competitors to breathe underwater, and I enjoyed plumbing the depths of a part of the grounds that had never been seen before. In the original draft of Chamber of Secrets, I had Harry and Ron crash into the lake in Mr. Weasley's Ford Anglia and meet the merpeople there for the first time. At that time, I had a vague notion that the lake might lead to other places, and that the merpeople might play a larger role in the later books than they did. So I thought that Harry ought to be introduced to both at this stage. However, the Whomping Willow provided a more satisfying, less distracting crash, and served a later purpose in Prisoner of Azkaban too. The Great Lake, which is really a Scottish loch, apparently freshwater and landlocked, never did develop as a portal to other seas or rivers, although the appearance of the Durmstrang ship from its depths in Goblet of Fire hints at the fact that if you are travelling by an enchanted craft, you might be able to take a magical shortcut to other waterways. Giant squid genuinely exist, though they are most mysterious creatures. Although their extraordinary bodies have been washed up all over the world, it was not until 2006 that a live giant squid was captured on film by muggles. I strongly suspect them of having magical powers.
Hufflepuff Common Room. Back in the castle, albeit several floors down, the Hufflepuff Common Room is as warm and cosy as the Great Lake is wet and inhospitable. Harry may never have reason to visit, but in true Hufflepuff style, their common room is always ready to welcome its students.
The Hufflepuff Common Room is entered from the same corridor as the Hogwarts kitchens. Proceeding past the large still life that forms the entrance to the latter, a pile of large barrels is to be found stacked in a shadowy stone recess on the right-hand side of the corridor. The barrel, two from the bottom, middle of the second row, will open if tapped in the rhythm of Helga Hufflepuff.
Footnote. The complexity or otherwise of the entrance to the common rooms might be said to give a very rough idea of the intellectual reputation of each house. Hufflepuff has an unchanging portal and requires rhythmic tapping. Slytherin and Gryffindor have doorways that challenge the would-be entrant about equally, the former having an almost imperceptible hidden entrance and a varying password, the latter having a capricious guardian and frequently changing passwords. In keeping with its reputation as the house of the most agile minds at Hogwarts, the door to the Ravenclaw common room presents a fresh intellectual or philosophical challenge every time a person knocks on it. Nevertheless, it ought not to be concluded from the above that Hufflepuffs are dimwits or duffers, though they have been cruelly caricatured that way on occasion. Several outstanding brains have emerged from Hufflepuff House over the centuries. These fine minds simply happen to be allied to outstanding qualities of patience, a strong work ethic, and constancy, all traditional hallmarks of Hufflepuff House.
As a security device to repel non-Hufflepuffs, tapping on the wrong barrel, or tapping the incorrect number of times, results in one of the other lids bursting off and drenching the interloper in vinegar. A sloping, earthy passage inside the barrel travels upwards a little way until a cozy, round, low-ceilinged room is revealed, reminiscent of a badger's set. The room is decorated in the cheerful, bee-like colours of yellow and black, emphasised by the use of highly polished, honey-coloured wood for the tables and the round doors which lead to the boys' and girls' dormitories, furnished with comfortable wooden bedsteads all covered in patchwork quilts. A colourful profusion of plants and flowers seems to relish the atmosphere of the Hufflepuff common room. Various cacti stand on wooden circular shelves curved to fit the walls, many of them waving and dancing at passers-by, while copper-bottomed plant holders dangling amid the ceiling cause tendrils of ferns and ivies to brush your hair as you pass under them. A portrait over the wooden mantelpiece, carved all over with decorative dancing badges, shows Helga Hufflepuff, one of the four founders of Hogwarts School, toasting her students with a tiny, two-handled golden cup. Small round windows just level with the ground at the foot of the castle show a pleasant view of rippling grass and dandelions, and occasionally passing feet. These low windows notwithstanding, the room feels perennially sunny.
Author's note. When I first planned the series, I expected Harry to visit all four house common rooms during his time at Hogwarts. There came a point when I realised that there was never going to be a valid reason to enter the Hufflepuff room. Nevertheless, it is quite as real to me as the other three, and I always knew exactly where those Hufflepuffs were going when they headed off towards the kitchens after lessons.
The Marauder's Map. And now we end our exploration of Hogwarts with those purveyors of aids to magical mischief makers, Remus Lupin, Peter Pettigrew, Sirius Black, and James Potter, aka Messrs. Moony, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs, aka the Marauders. Their magnificent map of the castle and its grounds is not only invaluable to other troublemakers such as Fred and George Weasley, but also an incredible magical tool that offers an unfettered view of Hogwarts to anyone with the ability to access it. Not Snape, then.
Perhaps no students, even including Harry Potter, Ron Weasley, Hermione Granger, and Tom Riddle, have ever explored the castle and grounds of Hogwarts as thoroughly and illicitly as the four creators and contributors to The Marauder's Map: James Potter, Sirius Black, Remus Lupin, and Peter Pettigrew. James, Sirius, and Peter were not initially impelled to explore the school grounds by night out of devilment alone, though that played its part, but by their desire to help their dear friend Remus Lupin to bear his lycanthropy. Prior to the invention of the Wolfsbane potion, Lupin was compelled to undergo an excruciating transformation every full moon. Once his condition was discovered by his three best friends, they sought a way to render his transformations less solitary and painful, which led to them learning to become, unregistered, animagi, so that they could keep him company without harm to themselves. The ability of Sirius Black, Peter Pettigrew and James Potter to become, respectively, a dog, a rat and a stag, enabled them to explore the castle grounds by night undetected. The interior of the castle, meanwhile, was mapped over time with the help of James Potter's invisibility cloak. The Marauder's map is a lasting testimony to the advanced magical ability of the four friends, who included Harry Potter's father, godfather, and favorite teacher. The map they created during their time at Hogwarts appears to be a blank piece of parchment unless activated by the phrase, "I solemnly swear that I am up to no good." A phrase that, in the case of three of the four makers, should be understood as a joke. The "no good" of which they wrote never denoted dark magic, but school rule-breaking. Similar bravado is evinced by their use of their own nicknames on the map: Messrs. Mooney, Wormtail, Padfoot and Prongs. The magic used in the map's creation is advanced and impressive. It includes the homunculus charm, enabling the possessor of the map to track the movements of every person in the castle. And it was also enchanted to forever repel, as insultingly as possible, the curiosity of their nemesis, Severus Snape. Although the precise circumstances surrounding the Maker's loss of their map are not given in the Harry Potter novels, it is easy to conclude that they eventually overreached themselves and were cornered by Argus Filch, probably on a tip-off from Snape, whose obsession it had become to expose his arch-rival James Potter in wrongdoing. The masterpiece of a map was confiscated in Sirius, James, Remus and Peter's final year, and none of them were able to steal it back from a well-prepared and suspicious Filch. In any case, their priorities changed in their final months at school, becoming far more serious and focused on the world beyond Hogwarts, where Lord Voldemort was successfully rising to power. All four of the map's creators would shortly be inducted into the renegade organization headed by Albus Dumbledore, the Order of the Phoenix, and a map of their old school, no matter how ingenious, would no longer be of use to them, except as a piece of nostalgia. The Marauder's map was, however, of immense use to the young Weasley twins. The story of Fred and George's acquisition of the map is told in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. It was a mark of their high esteem for Harry Potter, and their belief that he stood in need of assistance with a destiny none of them yet fully understood, that they later gifted the map to him, unwittingly passing it on to the child of one of the creators. The map was subsequently confiscated from Harry Potter by a Death Eater in disguise at the school, who recognized it as a likely source of his own discovery.
Author's note. The Marauder's map subsequently became something of a bane to its true originator, me, because it allowed Harry a little too much freedom of information. I never showed Harry taking the map back from the empty office of the supposed Mad-Eye Moody, and I sometimes regretted that I had not capitalized on this mistake to leave it there. However, I like the moment when Harry watches Ginny's dot moving around the school in Deathly Hallows, so on balance, I am glad I let Harry reclaim his rightful property.
We've explored as much of Hogwarts as the Marauder's map shows, and more. Mischief managed? Well, perhaps. For now. By the time the Weasley twins bequeath the Marauder's map to Harry, they already know the map's contents by heart. "We don't really need it anymore," says George. And yet, if this trip through the wizarding world has demonstrated anything, it's that even with a wand in your hand and a magical map in your pocket, it's impossible to explore every alley and corridor, From the travails of transport, to the complexities of muggle-wizarding relationships, to the almost impenetrable mysteries of wand-making, there's a lot to get to grips with. We began this journey with baby Harry asleep on the Dursleys' doorstep. Since then, we've travelled all the way to Hogwarts right alongside him, and still we've only skimmed the surface, which is as it should be. Harry's magical education happens inside a building full of trick staircases, moving portraits and third-floor corridors guarded by three-headed dogs, and that's not even mentioning the grounds. Hogwarts is so full of secrets, even the Marauder's map can't reveal them all. The Room of Requirement is unplottable. Professor Binns believed the Chamber of Secrets was a myth. Dumbledore himself never found either. And yet, Hogwarts might be unknowable, but it is by no means unwelcoming. On the contrary, it provides sanctuary for anyone who seeks it. Sirius and Snape, McGonagall and Trelawney, Harry and Voldemort, Lupin, Draco, Hagrid. For a drafty old castle, it's pretty warm. So as the Hogwarts house elves pack the great hall full of delicious food and the common room fires continue to burn bright, we'll draw the curtains tight round the four-poster bed and say farewell, but not goodbye, to this magical place. Besides, if we let the wizarding world keep some of its secrets, that means there will always be something else for someone to explore there in its alleys and corridors.
You have been listening to From the Wizarding Archive, curated writing from the world of Harry Potter, written by J.K. Rowling, a Pottermore Publishing production. The foreword was written by Ivana Lynch. Additional material was written by Nicola Slavin. And the project editor was Dan Franklin. By purchasing this audiobook, you support Lumos's mission to fight for every child's right to a family by transforming care systems around the world. Lumos works to ensure that all children grow up in safe and loving families. Article text is copyright J.K. Rowling, 2012 to 2016. Additional text and this recording are copyright J.K. Rowling, 2024. This audiobook was read by Ivana Lynch, Hugh Quashie, Finley Robertson, and Lara Sawala. This audiobook was produced by Pottermore Publishing. It was recorded at Molinaire Studios in 2024 and directed by David Darlington, with sound design by Molinaire and music by Sarah Carvalho. With special thanks to Anne Scantlebury, Graham Sidwell, Lauren Fox, Peyton Flood, Jasmine Turley, Susie Wolfe, and Luke Barnard. By purchasing this audiobook, you are supporting Lumos's mission to realize every child's right to a family by transforming care systems around the world. Lumos works to ensure that all children grow up in safe and loving families. There are at least 5.4 million children living in orphanages worldwide, even though 80% of them are not orphans. Most children are sent to institutions because of poverty, conflict, or discrimination. And while many institutions are established or supported with good intentions, more than 80 years of research proves that raising children in such places harms their health and development, increases their exposure to abuse and trafficking, and seriously reduces their chance of a happy, healthy future. Put simply, children need families, not orphanages. Lumos, a charity founded by J.K. Rowling, is named after the light-giving spell from Harry Potter that brings light to the darkest of places. At Lumos, that is exactly what we do. We reveal the children hidden away in institutions and transform systems of care globally so that all children have the families they need and the futures they deserve. Thank you for buying this book. If you would like to join J.K. Rowling and Lumos as part of our global movement for change, you can find out how to get involved at wearelumos.org, at Lumos, and lumos.at.work on Facebook. Lumos is the operating name of Lumos Foundation, a company limited by guarantee. Registered in England and Wales. Number 5611912. Registered charity number 1112575. Wizarding World and related trademarks, characters, names and indicia are trademark and copyright Warner Brothers Entertainment Incorporated. Wizarding World publishing and theatrical stage rights are copyright J.K. Rowling. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.